This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Today I have the privilege of visiting with the former beauty contestant winner, Little Miss Happy Texas, and also the author of a book titled Unstuck, One Heroine's Journey of Art and Courage to Live on Purpose. And joining me from the Northeast is author Vicki Todd. Thank you for joining me, Vicki.
Wow, thank you. That was quite an introduction.
Well, I hope the rest of it goes as well as the introduction, then, if you liked it. You have a fascinating story, and certainly one that's courageous. I loved looking not only at your book, which is not super long. It's, what, 60, 70 pages, something like that. It's,
right.
It has artwork in it and has your story. Share with my listeners a little of Happy Texas, because that's not where you live right now, and it is a real place.
It is a real place. My family still lives there, so I go and visit. Happy Texas is in the panhandle of Texas between Amarillo and Lubbock. There are 600 and some odd people in the town, and I graduated with 11 in 1984 from high school.
Well, do they object to you calling them some odd, or is that just an expression from West Texas? You said there are 670. You said there are 674 odd people there. I don't know. Happy Texas is a great name, but Happy Texas was not necessarily the outcome of your life. You became married. You were a stay-at-home mom. You had a degree, but then life changes came, and you have done what you call two flips in your life since maybe the late 90s. Share with my listeners why this book got written.
Okay. In 1998, I was in my seventh year of marriage, and it wasn't going that great. You know, it wasn't the best marriage. I had never wanted to have children, and nothing against moms or kids, but I had just always known intuitively that that was not my path. And so in that seventh year, my mom, who had always been a mom and a housewife, really wanted me to have a child. And so we went back and forth, fought about it, and I finally gave in and surrendered. And so I did end up becoming pregnant, but then lost the baby in May of 1998. And I had not been working. My husband was a hairdresser, and so he wanted to open his own salon. And so I had quit working 4.5 years before. And so I was just totally lost and floundering, and many nights found myself on the bathroom floor during the night, just really crying and praying and saying, God, you know, this is wrong. I don't want to be married. I don't want to have a baby. Help. You know, I feel stuck. And literally 2 months later, in July of 1998, I got a call from my former dean at Texas Tech University, and he had seen the feature story that I placed in the newspaper promoting the salon. And he said, hey, you know, do you want to come teach a public relations writing class this summer? And oh, by the way, it starts tomorrow.
Oh, boy.
And so I was just shaking in my shoes, but I knew I had to do it, because if I said no, I would remain stuck. I knew my marriage wasn't going well. I had to get out. This was the key to freedom. So I taught the first class that summer. My dean said, you know, great job. Have you thought about getting your doctorate? No, I've never thought about going back for a doctorate degree. But I did, and that took 4 years. I taught part-time at Texas Tech while I was working on it, got divorced, and then found an assistant professor position teaching public relations at a university in Connecticut. And so I moved by myself in 2003, and that's when I went back to painting. I didn't teach painting. I had always been surrounded by art because my grandmother and aunt in Happy had taught oil painting classes, and they're both artists. So it was there, but I just always saw it as a part-time hobby.
It was in your DNA, because at 3 years old, when you were in the Miss Happy contest, and actually won that contest, even though there were some odd people in that town, you were asked what you wanted to do when you got older, and what was your response?
an artist. And so it just came out of that little smaller version of me. So it's always been there. But, you know, you're told, oh, art is a frivolous hobby. Do it after retirement. And so I had just forgotten about it. But going through that tumultuous period of going through divorce, going back from my doctorate degree and knowing that I was going to have to move, I just gravitated to art. And I don't know why, because I had never painted on canvas before, but I just started doing these female portraits. And I did my first three before I moved, Inner Beauty Blooming, Defiance, and Sea of Hope. And I thought, wait a minute, you're painting a visual diary of what's happening in your life.
Yes.
So that's where it started.
And you've had, I mean, you didn't start out with formal training in the art world. It just was a talent that was hidden or suppressed. Is that also a way to describe that?
I took probably five art classes, you know, throughout college just as electives, but it was not my degree.
Your book, how would you describe for my listeners the visuals, not only that are in the book, but also the underlying theme that you're trying to convey?
The visuals in the book, I've chosen, I think it's 12 of my memoir visual diary portraits that correlate with the story. I call them memoir portraits because they represent what's happening in my life at certain snapshots in time. So as people read Unstuck, they'll get the story of my two life flips in words, but also there are the portraits that go along with the story in color, so you can really see what they look like. So what I really want to get across with the book is I truly believe we all have a purpose for why we were born and placed on this earth. We all have gifts that we were born with that we're meant to share. And I truly believe, because I'm living it, if you can find out what your purpose is, what those gifts are, and actually work that into your life, you know, you don't have to totally uproot your life and move across the country. And, you know, eventually I taught at Quinnipiac University in Connecticut for 12 years, but I resigned a year ago. I was tenured, and I resigned with no safety net because I needed to follow this purpose of using my art to inspire others to fulfill their own purpose. And so that's the message of the book, is we all have a purpose. We all have gifts that we're meant to use. If you can incorporate them into your life, you're going to be so much more joyful and peaceful and have a vibrant, textured life. But you don't have to go crazy like I've done. You know, you could weave it into your current life now. Maybe one Saturday a month, you know, you want to go volunteer to, you know, help the elderly. Or maybe you want to be a writer so you can, you know, carve out 15 minutes a day to write one paragraph. But if you can find time, your life is going to be so much more joyful for yourself, and it will make the world a better place.
Your book is not just a coffee table book then either. It is actually a motivational book to some degree.
Yes. I have taken my teaching skills. You know, I taught 17 years from Texas Tech to Quinnipiac at the university level, and so that teacher is ingrained in me. So at the end of the book, I have an Honor Your Purpose action sheet that will be four questions to kind of get you started on the road to finding out what your purpose is. And, of course, there has to be an art project. And so, you know, it's the reading of my story, seeing the visual diary portraits, but then also giving you some tips and some of these takeaways to work it into your own life.
Is there a family history of courage and courageous action from your grandmother or mother or other family members?
Oh, gosh. I am the only person in my family who has moved this far away solo.
Right.
But I just think, you know, my father was a farmer and rancher. So was my brother. My brother is the fourth generation on the farm. And, you know, they've always been self-employed. And that takes a lot of courage. You know, that's what I'm doing now, too. And it's scary. You know, it's scary at times. So I think that that entrepreneurial spirit is definitely ingrained in me.
I love the title of your book, Unstuck, because most of us, whether it's me or someone who's listening, have a part of their life that they feel a little bit conflicted about. Maybe it's a decision they've made in the past or one that they are considering for the future. What would you say is a first step in order to get unstuck?
I think if people listening are like me, I really didn't know what my purpose was until the age of 47. And that happened when I started meditating in 2013. So this was a full decade after I had moved from Texas to Connecticut. My art was a forgotten part-time hobby because I was figuring out, you know, how to be a professor. And I started meditating, and Deepak Chopra said, if you could be anything in life, no fear, no obstacles, what would that be? And an artist popped up in my mind. For me, that's how it started. If you don't know what your purpose is, I would say go back to your childhood. You know, look at old photos, talk to family members, and think about what were those activities that really lit you up, you know, made your heart sing, because those are breadcrumb clues to what your purpose is in life.
This book is your own story, but is it similar to other books in the marketplace, or do you think it has some uniqueness to it and maybe some motivational messages that need to be told?
I think it is similar in the fact that there are books out there that talk about, you know, following your purpose. I think with my book, what makes it unique is, you know, I've just been crazy enough to flip my life twice. I have, in addition, after I finished Unstuck, I went and taught in a little mini workshop and did an art talk at an art center in Redmond, Washington. And the next day, the lady who founded it and asked me to come to that organization said, we have, you know, I'm stepping down as executive director. Would you like to step into that position? And so I'm leaving at the end of May from Connecticut to move to Washington to do that. So I think that's what makes the story unique is my courage, my ability to become unstuck and just kind of go with the flow. I also think that the message about surrendering to the process, which is not easy for me. You know, I'm not a patient person. I want things to happen now. But surrendering to that flow of the universe is so important. And also listening to your intuition, that inner voice, not your ego voice that is scared and fearful, but that intuition inside. For me, meditation helps me really tap into that. But that can show you piece by piece the next right step. And so I think by telling my experience with those things, with the art, that makes Unstuck unique.
On a personal level, as a child, were you ever described as hyperactive or hyperkinetic?
Not necessarily hyperactive, but my mom has told me a story several times when I was probably 2 years old and trying to work on a puzzle. And I was stuck, you know, with the puzzle. And she said, would you like some help? And she said, I said, I do it myself. So I think I've had that stubbornness
That's a good thing. That's a good thing. The title of the book, again, is Unstuck, One Heroine's Journey of Art and the Courage to Live on Purpose. Wonderful subtitle. Vicki, my listeners will need to get a copy of your book. How do they do that?
Oh, great. Yes. They can go to my website if you would like a signed copy, and it's Vicki World Art, V-I-C-K-I, World Art. .com, or you can go to the BalboaPress.com or Barnes & Noble or Amazon.
Absolutely, and they can go to their local bookseller and request it by name, Unstuck, and under the author's name, Vicki Todd. Vicki, is there another book in the future, or is this just the beginning or the ending of your story?
This is just the beginning. I already have a contract for a second book in which I want to interview other artists and talk about their story of following their purpose of being an artist.
Great. This sounds like a fascinating study that you'll be engaging in. Hope to visit with you again. The title of this book, again, is Unstuck. My author, Vicki Todd, has joined me from Connecticut, and next time, who knows where she'll be. Thank you again for joining me today.
Thank you.
For Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press, this is J. Douglas Sparker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Congratulations on being the proud owner of an adorable, soft, cuddly, sweet-smelling, smiling, cooing, hungry, tired, gassy, screaming little bundle of joy. So now what? Where's the owner's manual for this thing? Where are my instructions? Right here. It's Baby and Toddler Instructions with Blythe Lipman on toginet.com.
Infant care specialist Blythe Lippman has worked with babies for over 20 years and works extensively with new parents, providing workshops, in-home visits, tips, and daily phone calls to ease those frazzled nerves. With baby and toddler instructions, you can get the advice you need on how to survive and enjoy your baby's first year. For more information on Blythe and how she can help you, go to babyinstructions.com. From 32 ways to stop a baby from crying to 14 ways to get a baby to eat and so much more, it's Baby and Toddler Instructions with Blythe Lippman on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world.
The title of the book, WTF, Where's the Fraud? How to Unmask and Stop Identity Frauds Draining on Our Government. The authors are Larry Benson and Andy Buchholz, and Larry joins us on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to you by Archway Publishing. Hello, Larry.
Steve, how are you?
Great to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Well, this is a scary, scary subject, because when it comes right down to it, as you point out, not only is it a national epidemic, identity fraud, probably every one of us, we have had our identity stolen.
That's correct. If you look at the statistics for last year, over 700 data breaches added up to over a billion identities went out the door. And if you look at the number of people in the U.S., there's 320 million roughly. Just the math alone says that your identity has been stolen three times over. It really becomes a question of, when is your identity going to be used by the criminals? And in most cases, those criminals will take your identity, knowing that it was just recently stolen. They'll put it on the shelf. It's like a fine wine. They're just going to age it. And in case that you've gotten identity theft protection, they'll wait 2 or 3 years and then finally pull it off the shelf once you've let that protection lapse, and they will be happy to use it.
Well, we'll talk more about protection in a bit, but let's find out about your background and why you wrote the book.
I started about four years ago actually sending articles out to some of the LexisNexis salespeople saying, your customers may want to know about this. They probably do, but just in case they don't. So they started forwarding them on, and these are topics on unemployment, and food stamps, government housing. And to my surprise, I got an awful lot of responses saying that their customers had no idea that this type of fraud was going on in their agencies. And they asked if they could be put on a mailing list. So I started a small mailing list, 50 people. It grew to 100. And then I got a call from my CEO saying, what's going on with this emailing that you're doing every day? And once I explained what I was doing, trying to educate these people, because I was finding more and more of them really didn't know how their agencies were being defrauded, he turned around and said, we're going to turn this into a national program. We're going to open it up to any of the government agencies that would like to subscribe. And now we have about 17,000 government officials that subscribe to an email every day called Fraud of the Day. And I push out an email on housing fraud, women, infants, and children's fraud, known as WIC fraud, SNAP fraud, which is the old food stamps, unemployment, you name it. We cover probably about 40 to 50 different types of government fraud. We report on it. And what we're trying to do is educate those government officials that don't know how their agencies are being defrauded. Now, what happens is you'll find one agency gets defrauded, and the criminals will use that same methodology on the next agency. So if I'm good at getting stealing from unemployment, I'll try and take that same methodology and export it over to tax refund fraud, food stamp fraud, et cetera, and take those same identities that I was using on unemployment and work them across multiple agencies at the same time.
Just overwhelming, but unfortunately, in today's high-tech world, makes sense. We hear a lot about identity fraud, but here we're talking about, as you calculate, each workday that goes by, we are losing over $110 million to this crime?
Yeah. In total, we've estimated across the entire federal government, this is just federal government, it costs about $27 billion a year.
So
it's,
who
it's real money.
So who are these criminals?
This is truly a crime of opportunity. They're everything from a mom and pop shop all the way up to organized criminals that are offshore and have, you know, if not dozens, hundreds of people working behind computers stealing identities and fraudulently submitting to get government benefits. So it's everything from I hire someone to work for me and I go and say, okay, we're going to go perpetrate a crime. I'm going to get you a job at the local doctor's office. Now, you've seen, Steve, when you walk into the doctor's office, traditionally they have all the folders across the back of the room where the administrator works.
Right.
And it's everybody's medical records.
Right.
And what I'll do is I'll get somebody to work there on the night shift cleaning, and I'll say to that person, okay, every night I want you to take down 10 folders, open it to the first page. Now, the first page is, that's the sheet they give you the first time you come to the doctor's office, and it says, fill in your name, your address, your social security number, your date of birth, all your medical history.
Sure.
So whenever, in other words, everything I need to steal your identity, and I want you to take a quick photograph of it.
Mm-hmm.
So now I snap a photo of it, shut the folder, go to the next one, snap a photograph. Those 10 photographs that took probably all of 60 seconds to take are worth about $1,000, about $100 a piece. So that person working on the night crew at that doctor's office can make $1,000 a night in 1 minute. Now I take that identity, I send it off to the criminal that's hired me, and now they're out there selling it and utilizing it to get, as I said before, food stamps, unemployment, and not just tax refunds, or not just unemployment in one state. I now can export this to multiple states at the same time. Remember, there's 43 states that have an income tax. So if I steal your identity, I can now go to potentially 42 other states. I'm assuming you're in a state with an income tax. I can go to 42 other states, and I could submit, and I'll say, I'm Steve. Here's my social. I work at Walmart as a manager. I made $150,000, and you kept $5,500. I'd like that back, please. They'll send you a check for $5,500.
Well, back in 2012, as pointed out in your book, the police couldn't understand why drug dealers were disappearing off of street corners. But again, the evidence was clear and the reason was clear.
Yeah. These drug dealers, these criminals, they're great business people. And they also realized risk and reward. Why am I going to deal drugs when I can make more money going after government benefits? I can work at home in my bunny slippers, and I won't get shot. So less risk, higher reward, I can have my own work at home program. Nothing wrong with that. The problem is they're stealing from us. And it's not just a few dollars. We're talking about criminals that make $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a week. Cash.
So
it's a serious crime.
So obviously a real gold mine, and the government really doesn't know how to they really don't understand how to protect themselves, and of course you're there to help them, but is this possible? Is there a way to stop this fraud?
Well, it depends. Which one are we talking about?
Oh, boy. Oh, my goodness.
Are we talking about a specific fraud, or are we talking about identity theft?
Mm-hmm. So there's fraud where you have people just taking advantage of the system, just scamming the system.
Each system is different. There's number one. What each system does depend on, though, is understanding who the citizens are and who the beneficiaries are. So let's take tax refund fraud. The solution that I see there, right now, if I steal your identity and quickly spin up a tax return and submit it and ask for a refund and I get it in before you, I'll actually get the refund and they will refuse your tax return. So one of the things that we could do is say across the board, across the whole country, The IRS, they came out with a mandate saying, we will deliver no refunds until after April 15th, when everybody's got their tax return in. Then we're going to look for duplicates. If there are duplicates, those will be investigated. If there are not duplicates and you've requested a refund, they'll go out right away. But I don't see the IRS bringing this to the table. Right now, they're doing a game called pay and chase. They're going to pay out to the first one that submits, and if they find out that you're a criminal, then they're going to try and chase it later. But it's literally years later. Well, and in most cases, they never get the money back. They're saying this year alone, the IRS will pay out to criminals on tax refund fraud an estimated $5.8 billion. It's real money the last time I checked.
What about all our cards, debit cards, credit cards that we carry around with us? We're told that those numbers can be stolen.
They can be.
And is there a way to protect? I mean, we hear about these special wallets that protect us. Is that really protecting us?
Well, let's look at this closely. When it comes to credit cards, if somebody gets your credit card number and uses it, you're responsible for the first $50. It's not a big deal. It's a problem. It's got to be dealt with, but it's not a big deal. If it's a debit card, they're into your bank account. So we strongly recommend that you don't even have a debit card. Because once they get into that cash, the bank is not responsible for that money. You are. All they're doing is giving you an avenue to be able to pay bills directly with your cash. So if it disappears, it's really your responsibility. So the challenge becomes with credit cards and debit cards is the number of offerings that you get in the mail. So, you know, you've seen the number of Visa offerings that you get from all the banks and the airlines, so on and so forth. The problem is if somebody gets a hold of those and fills it out with your name and gets a separate credit card that you don't know about in your name and then runs up the tab. Because the credit card company is going to ultimately call you and say, when are you going to pay this bill? And you're going to say, I didn't even know anything about this card. What are you talking about? That's where it becomes a challenge. At that point, what you want to do is you want to go to the three credit bureaus, Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian, and freeze your identity. There's a new function where you can take your identity and turn it off, where no one can actually get a credit card in your name.
Oh.
And then if you decide that you want to go get maybe a Home Depot credit card down the road, you actually can thaw your identity at whichever credit bureau that Home Depot uses, sit there and say to, let's say, TransUnion, I'm going to get a Home Depot credit card, thaw my identity just for Home Depot. After they check it, I want you to refreeze it. And now that automatically takes place.
You say the fraud of the future is health care fraud.
It is. It's just beginning. Right now, that's an estimated $60 billion a year that gets stolen right out of Medicare alone. Add Medicare and Medicaid together, you're closer to $100 billion in just fraud. Because remember, Medicare and Medicaid is a $1 trillion budgeted program, and so 10% of that is determined to be fraud. So this is taking off like crazy. Identity theft is playing a serious part because there's an awful lot of illegal aliens, people that don't have health care coverage right now. They're taking identities and getting health care under those identities. You've also got providers that are stealing identities, and they're racking up bills saying, we provided health care to the following people. Here are their Social Security numbers, and billing the U.S. government for services that were never rendered.
So what do we do now?
We have to recognize, this is kind of like an alcoholic. You've got to recognize the problem exists before you can fix it. So the people running these agencies need to stop with the standard, well, you know, fraud's only 1% of the program, so it's not that big of a deal, and recognize it is significantly higher. I was with the commissioner of one agency, an unemployment agency that will go unnamed. And when I sat with him, he said, yeah, our standard is that we tell everybody that the unemployment fraud in this state is 1%. He said, I just started here. He goes, we really hope it's less than 15%. And his budget was over $1 billion a year. So it's a serious problem across the board in all agencies. If we could actually stop the fraud problem, government fraud, we probably wouldn't have an annual national debt.
Overwhelming. WTF, where's the fraud? How to unmask and stop identity fraud's drain on our government? And we've been listening to Larry Benson, the author. Larry, what's the best way to get your book?
You can go right on Amazon, amazon.com. Look up WTF question mark and then the word fraud.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Steve, it was my pleasure. Thank you for your time.
And this interview has been brought to you by Archway Publishing.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Do you ever wonder if you're the only woman who runs errands in her yoga pants so it will look like she went to the gym? Or how about the only mom who feeds her kids raw cookie dough? Or are you the only one who cooks her family cold cereal for dinner? Do you need more laughter and less loudness? More self-love and less self-loathing? More joy and less judgment? You're not alone. Come to the living room. A place where we get comfy, candid, and confident together. Come seeking sanctuary and leave feeling renewed. We're saving a seat for you. Give yourself some living room today.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world.
The title of the book, Bam Bam, The Prince of Valpreva, and the author, Little Anthony. And Little Anthony joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to you by Archway Publishing. Hello, Little Anthony.
Hello.
Great to have you on the show. Bam Bam, this is quite a mostly true story, as you put it, but a tiny cat found lost on the streets of Palm Beach, and he gets rescued by a little girl, and then the adventure starts. And
yes,
it is a bit of a unbelievable story to some degree. Some may even call it a fairy tale.
Yes, very much so. Yes, this poor little thing was on the streets all by itself, and somehow ended up with me through the girl who found him, and now he's prince of a castle in France. It's an incredible story. He's actually a real prince in a real castle in France.
And of course, if you have a prince, you must have a princess.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, part of wanting to write the story was that he almost didn't make it to the castle because something happened to him. He almost doesn't make it. And I said to myself, oh my God, there can't be a princess without a prince. So he's got to make it through the situation that he goes through. But he comes out okay and makes it to the castle.
Obviously, you're a cat lover. But what are the reasons did you write the book?
Well, I wrote the book because I thought Bam Bam's story had a lot of great messages for kids. You know, you can start your life anywhere, on the street even, and still end up a prince, that you never really know how your life's going to play out. And I truly believe that this cat knew that the way to make it in this world was to be nice to people. This is the kind of cat who, after 10 minutes with anybody, he'll sit on your lap and make you love him. And I just thought that that was a great message for kids in terms of, you know, being good, if you will, and finding ways of making your way through life that way. There were also many other reasons for writing the book, including references to different cultures, you know, the French culture, and French words figure prominently in the book, as well as some Jewish, Yiddish words. And I thought the multiculturalism part of the book was also interesting. And quite honestly, also, I can't think of another children's book that is set in Miami Beach.
Set in Miami Beach, but ends up in a castle in France.
Yes. Well, in addition to Bam Bam, another cat landed in my arms named Bijou. And Bijou was, or is, the princess of a queen in France who has a castle. And Bijou and Bam Bam fall in love, and, well, they both fly over to France to live in the castle, ultimately.
So you have some themes of adventure, love, and thankfulness.
Yes, and also about letting go. I mean, Bam Bam grows up, and he moves away, very much like what happens with parents. You know, they raise their children, and eventually the children grow up and lead their own lives.
You are particularly connected to France in that you formed a nonprofit in the wake of the terrible terror in Paris last year.
Yes. What happened in Paris is beyond comprehension. And in some way, with this book, I felt, well, there's very little that I can do for Paris, per se, being just, you know, one person, but there's something I can do for a small village 3 hours outside of Paris, known as Valpervas, where there is a castle where Bantam now lives with Princess Bijou. And yes, we formed a non-for-profit called the American Friends of the Chateau de Valpervas, and we're going to support the music and literature and art programs at the castle. And actually, we're going to be looking for little Anthony's and another character in the story named Little Inez. We're going to be looking for little Inez's and little Anthony's all around the country to read to other children in their schools and libraries and homes and friends, with the chance of one of them getting to go over to France and visit with the cats in the castle, doing this through the nonprofit.
This may be a simple story for children, but at the same time, it's a bit sophisticated.
Yes, the story is very multi-layered and has a lot of hidden meanings and in it, and it's really for the readers to see it if they wish, and if not, they can accept it just as a simple story.
So you see children today better educated, and they would really be able to understand what you were trying to say.
Very much so. I mean, my favorite books, like Make Way for Ducklings, Curious George, Barbar, all the books that I love to read, they're, when I look at them today relative to how sophisticated children are today, I do think that children are much more sophisticated than those books, and that's why I do think that this book will be important in children's literature in the long run.
Not only a great story, but lots of photos, colorful photos of Bam Bam and her adventure.
Yes, yes, absolutely. In fact, I felt very strongly that I wanted the real photographs. I didn't take pictures with the intent of eventually writing a book. When the sequence events sort of came together that he was going to become a prince and move to France seemed so remarkable to me, I kind of looked back at the pictures I had and I said, wow, I have a great little story here to tell the world. And so while I was advised to make it an animated book, I felt that the realness of the real pictures added measurably to the whole story and made it feel more real. The graininess of the pictures make it look like anyone could have taken these pictures. And that was part of what I wanted to come out of the book, not to make it idealized, but really to make it something real.
And of course, when you start a book once upon a time, you know that there are a lot of surprises ahead.
Yes, there are a lot of surprises ahead. Just when you think everything's perfect, things get turned upside down, and then you got to figure it out all over again. You can never be too sure. Just when you think you've landed in the perfect spot, things get turned around, and you got to rethink things. And then things turned around over and over. One of the great lessons of the story is being resilient, which Bam Bam certainly was, having to move around like a nomad from place to place, and surviving transitions, being flexible. He really, even though he's a cat, he demonstrates a lot of qualities that I think are important for everyone, whether you're a child or even as an adult.
Bam Bam, the Prince of Valpreva. How do we get this book, little Anthony?
Well, you go to the Archway Publishing site, and you can order it direct from the publisher.
And, of course, anyone can go to any retail bookseller, and they will order it, receive this great children's story, kind of a fairy tale, kind of an unbelievable story, but one with a great message. Thank you for being on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you for having me.
And this interview is brought to you by Archway Publishing.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.